It was the disease that struck fear into the hearts of parents around the world through much of the past century, and it's still the case in two of the world's poorest nations, Afghanistan and Pakistan. Otherwise, polio has very nearly been eradicated worldwide, with only 359 cases reported last year. Dr. Kerry Hiley is a medical historian. He's written a social history of polio. It's called Dancing in My Dreams, Confronting the Spectre of Polio. Today is World Polio Day, and Kerry Hiley joins us from our Canberra studios. Kerry Hiley, welcome to RN Breakfast.
Oh, good morning, Fran. Thank you for inviting me.
Today, polio is almost a completely preventable disease. It can be treated with a vaccine, costs as little as 60 cents. How far away are we, do you think, from total eradication?
Well, you'd really have to ask the people at Rotary for those sorts of figures. But I think, I was speaking to Frank Fenner before he died. Recently, he was a world authority on viruses, and he did say to me, he was sort of a bit doubtful whether it would actually ever be eradicated. So I guess we just have to wait and see, really.
I think it's fair to say the memory of it and the fear of it won't be eradicated for a very long time anyway. In your book, you write, quote, polio generated panic and fear in families with young children. It arrived silently and suddenly. We're talking about, you know, the middle of last century by and large. Tell us about that time, can you? And tell us about the arrival of polio.
Well, the thing was that it, I think because of the fact that it did strike so suddenly. I mean, one day your child was happy and running around the backyard and playing with his friends, and then as often they'd complain of something that parents thought may have just been a cold or a sore throat, or perhaps they'd sort of eaten something that didn't agree with them. And the next morning they would wake up, or perhaps during the night, and they'd be screaming with pain and couldn't walk or move their limbs. So it was almost as though it was sort of stalking.
Horrifying.
Children. It is. It was absolutely horrifying.
And it was children always that were struck?
Well, in the early days it was called infantile paralysis because of the fact that it didn't tend to affect children. But as time went on and children weren't being exposed to the virus at an early age, which is how you developed immunity to it, the incidence was increasing, and probably by about the 50s and 60s it was more common in young adults.
And when it struck like that, as you say, sort of coming suddenly and silently with that pain and that paralysis, that didn't go away. Was that in any cases just a temporary thing, or did it always require, you know, intense therapy?
Well, yeah, that was what was called the acute phase, which was the sort of early phase, which lasted for sometimes 1 or 2 weeks when the pain was acute. And this was when Elizabeth Kenny, who I know you'll ask me about a bit later, wanted to introduce her treatment because she believed that treatment had to be introduced during this early phase. And to sort of lessen the effect of the treatment and to make it more bearable, she used hot packs to sort of make the muscles relax.
Which sounds soothing and sensible, but it was a was a very hotly debated, contested treatment. Her treatment was seen as unorthodox at the time.
Oh, definitely. I mean, the thing is that medicine in those days was, you know, I'm talking about the mid, you know, the early 20th century and going on to the middle of it, was it was a hierarchical system, and it was very much dominated by men. Elizabeth was a woman. She was a nurse. She wasn't fully qualified, which was one of her problems later on when people discovered that she wasn't in fact fully qualified. So she sort of came up against this opposition. I mean, and the opposition was directed at her first because, as I say, she was a woman, and doctors, they owned this area. They felt that they owned this area. This was their area of expertise, and that sort of scientific facts and treatment should be, it was part of the medical canon.
And so the orthodox treatment, you talk about Dr. Jean McNamara from Victoria, who was a proponent of the orthodox treatment, which was about splints and plaster casts and braces to control the body.
That's right. I mean, the orthodox treatment was The method used by people who followed this was that the body should be immobilised. It should be kept in a rigid position. And if you look at the photograph on the front of the book, you can see a little girl in what's called a Thomas splint. Now, this was to keep the body immobilised. And they advocated treatment to be kept in these splints for periods of up to 2 years. Which you could imagine was extremely traumatic for everyone, including the patient.
I've never forgotten the descriptions in I Can Jump Puddles, the Alan Marshall description of the therapy, his therapy for polio. I mean, he managed to convey the absolute agony of the exercises and the treatment. But I'm not sure now, with this distance, whether that was Elizabeth Kinney's style of treatment or Jean McNamara's. Do you know?
Well, the thing is that both of them believe that the muscles had to be sort of gently stretched to get them working again. I mean, the trouble was the limbs were paralysed into a sort of a contorted position, and to get the muscles moving again, you had to get those limbs moving again. The big controversy between the two women was when this treatment should be introduced. Should it be introduced early, or should it be introduced after a period of a year or more?
Okay, it's 29 past eight. Our guest is Dr. Kerry Hiley, author of Dancing in My Dreams: Confronting the Spectre of Polio. It's more a social history of polio rather than a medical history. And one really important observation that really surprised me is that the more advanced a country in public health standards of hygiene, the more likely it was to experience epidemics of polio. Why was that?
Well, the thing is that the optimum time for human beings to be introduced to the poliovirus is very early on. And this is why babies are given immunisation at around the age of 3 months, because this is the optimum time this gives the body the best chance of forming antibodies, which is the natural immunity towards disease. Now, with the increases in public health and sanitation that occurred at the beginning of the 20th century, children weren't being exposed to this particular virus at an early age. They were being prevented from, because everything was improving, we were getting better sanitation, which is also a sort of an argument for letting kids sort of form their own natural immunity.
Run
around in the dirt a bit, exactly.
Kerry, just finally and briefly, it hit Australia hard in the middle of last century, and there's many Australians, who still tell stories of they were affected by polio, some sort of permanent signs of it still, some not so. But even for all people who were affected by it, are they experienced late effects of having had polio?
Yes, they are. A lot. It's called post-polio syndrome, and what is happening, or what people believe is happening, is that these muscles that were damaged early in life or in midlife, as people become older, the muscles seem to be sort of regressing almost and sort of reverting and giving pain again, and people having to walk, to either go back into or use a crutch or something like this. So, yes, it's a huge problem. It's so sad when you consider what they went through. That they're again, in later life, they're again being confronted with the problem all over again.
Must be frightening. It's such an interesting medical history you've given us, Kerry. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Fran.
Dr. Kerry Hiley, she's a medical historian and author of Dancing in My Dreams, Confronting the Spectre of Polio, which is published by Monash University Publishing, and the launch today, World Polio Today, and a campaign by Rotary to eradicate it globally.